right, we're in Luke chapter 8. The passage that Abby read for you is actually what we're going to be, we'll be doing for the next several weeks. This week, we're just going to be going over the passage about being in the boat and having that thing get swamped with water. All right, all of these miracles that we're encountering this morning in the Gospel of Luke tell us something about Jesus. It tells us he was just no ordinary guy. All of us need to ask and answer a question in our life, and that question is, who is Jesus? Is he just one of many? Is he just another person, or is he a lot more than that? How you answer that question will change everything about you. It'll change how you live your life now, and according to Jesus, it will determine your eternal destiny. The way you answer that question will affect how you spend your money. It's going to mess with how you spend your time. It's going to rearrange your calendar, and it'll rearrange your checkbook. It's going to inform how you talk. It's going to change who you spend a lot of time with. It's going to adjust how you go through pain and suffering. It's a critical question, and frankly, every person needs to answer this question because of the claims Jesus made about himself. The claims he made about himself are somewhat spectacular. He said things like, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. He said, I and the Father are one. Philip, don't you believe? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. He made statements like, if you're ashamed of me, in my words, I will be ashamed of you in front of the angels in glory. Now, either those statements are true, or they're the ravings of a guy who's a little bit nutty. We can't come to Jesus kind of with the middle ground approach, although that's the way most people like to come to him. In 1978, there was a book written called The 100. It was written by an astrophysicist named Michael Hart. And he asked, who are the 100 most influential people in history? You'll be interested to note that Jesus came third on this list, just below Isaac Newton, who ironically was a devout follower of Jesus. On the top of the list, according to Hart, was Muhammad. He was the most influential person in history. Jesus, well, at least got the bronze medal, so good for him, right? Here's what Paul wrote about Jesus in Colossians chapter 1, 15 through 20. Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. In other words, when you've seen Jesus, you've seen God. He existed before anything was created. He was there already. And is supreme over all creation. For through him, God created everything in the heavenly realms and on earth. He made the things we can see and the things we can't see. Things such as thrones, kingdoms, rulers, and authorities in the unseen world. In other words, the spiritual realm. Everything was created through him and for him. He existed before everything else, and he holds creation together. Christ is also the head of the church, which is his body. He is the beginning, supreme over all who rise from the dead. So he is the first in everything. For God, in all his fullness, was pleased to live in Christ, and through him, God reconciled everything to himself. He made peace with everything in heaven and on earth by means of Christ's blood on the cross. So Paul ranks Jesus not first on a list of equals, so to speak. Paul ranks Jesus in a category all by himself. There is no one like him. There has never been anyone like him, and there will never ever be anyone like him on the face of this earth. He is the unique Son of God, the visible image of the invisible God. Now, either these things are true or they're not. That's why everybody has to deal with Jesus in one way or another. Either he is those things, thus he has rights to you and I. Or he is not any of those things, and let's go play golf in the rain today. That's the importance of Jesus. So in Luke, here beginning in chapter 8, verse 22, Luke is going to recount some miracles. And at the end of these, Luke wants all of his readers to know that Jesus, that we should respond to Jesus in faith because he is the God of creation. He rules over the natural realm. He rules over the physical realm. He is capable of healing diseases. He rules over the spiritual realm. He casts demons out. And he is life. He rules over death. Now that's pretty fascinating. It's pretty spectacular. So here's our focus question today as we come to, better turn it on, as we come to this passage in Luke chapter 8. How does the incident of Jesus stilling an actual storm, this was a real storm, how does that connect with our experience with him when we encounter personal storms in our lives? All right, so let's keep that question in mind as we go along. Here we go. First point is this. Doing the will of God does not ensure safety. Have a nice day. Doing the will of God does not ensure safety. Here's what the passage says. One day he got into a boat with his disciples, and he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side of the lake." So they set out. And as they sailed, he fell asleep. And a windstorm came down on the lake, and they were filling with water and were in danger. Now get the picture here. Jesus, after a long day of ministry, tells the disciples, "Let's get in the boat and let's go to the other side of the lake. It's been a long day. Let's have a nice ride from where we are to the other side." Now, the other side of the lake, if you're familiar with the Sea of Galilee, on the western side of the Sea of Galilee, it's pretty much Jewish. It's villages where those who dwelt in Galilee live. On the east side of the lake, it's almost all Gentile. There was a region there called the Decapolis. That means there were 10 cities. They were all Roman. They were Gentile in nature. And Jesus is telling his disciples, "Let's get in the boat and go there." None of them, I'm sure, wanted to go there. But Jesus was telling them, "Let's go there." They were pretty clear by this point in their experience with Jesus. When he says, "Let's go there," we got to go there. And so they got in the boat with him, and they went. Specifically, they were going to the country of the Gerasenes. Again, it's opposite Galilee, both geographically and ethnically and religiously. They were going into, in a sense, a foreign land, even though it wasn't all that far from them. So Jesus is taking them to a religiously uncomfortable area that would have no regard for their Jewish customs and religion. That's where he wanted to take them. Jesus ever wanted to take you someplace you don't want to go? Yep. That's where he takes us. He takes us to the very places we would not go on our own, but he takes us and he's present with us. Now, the Sea of Galilee, or as it's called also Lake Tiberias or Lake Kinneret, is only 5 miles wide and it's 13 miles long, so it's going to be about a 5 mile voyage across the lake. The disciples had done this hundreds of times, as they were, at least Peter, James, and John had. They were fishermen. The sea itself is nearly 700 feet below sea level, so it's low. And around the Sea of Galilee, it's surrounded by hills, imposing mountains, and gorged with deep ravines. The ravines can serve as gigantic funnels that bring winds whirling down upon the lake without notice whatsoever. These gales are often strengthened by a thermal buildup because of the altitude or the lack of altitude, and they're often strengthened, and in this extremely low valley, it gets pretty nasty pretty fast. We're familiar with Santa Ana winds right here. They have something similar there. And it would really stir up the Sea of Galilee. So this is what caught the disciples without warning. Luke says that the storm, he describes it as coming down. That's a very good way to describe the way storms happen there. It's a shoo, boom, and all of a sudden things have changed. Mark describes the storm. By the way, all three gospel writers have this account. Mark describes the storm with a Greek term, leilops, which is the word from which we get hurricane. By the way, there's a really big one again brewing out in the Atlantic. Matthew describes it with the word seismos. Now, we're from California. We are all aware of what seismic means. What's it mean? Earthquake. All right, so they all describe it in very brutal terms. This was not just a light gust of wind coming upon them. It was one nasty storm. In fact, they had so much trouble. Now, again, get the picture. Peter, James, and John had fished all of their lives on this very place. They were familiar with what the lake can do, but this got beyond their means. I'm sure as all 13 of them, including Jesus, were in this boat, they were trying their best to get the boat or turn it around or do something to get off that lake at that point, and they were not making it. They were in, as Luke says, severe danger. Here's the point. They were doing exactly what Jesus asked them to do. They were going across to the other side of the lake to do who knows what with completely unfamiliar people, and yet despite their obedience to Jesus being right in the center of his will, they get messed up. Here comes this storm that they had no control over. You know me, you know I'm a C.S. Lewis fan, the Chronicles of Narnia. When Aslan, the great lion, who is the Christ figure in these stories, is first presented to the children who come to Narnia, he is presented to them by Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. And they're trying to describe Aslan, the great lion, to these children. They do mention that, by the way, he is a lion. And so Lucy, the youngest of the girls, say, ooh, then is he safe? And they say, look, he's a lion. Well, then he isn't safe. And then Mr. Beaver says, safe? Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king. That's Jesus. He's not safe. He's not safe. When we follow him, he will take us into places that don't look safe to us. While he was in his body here on earth, he was not safe. He didn't take things easy. He's also, by the way, not safe in his glorified body. Now, John, the disciple perhaps who was the closest to Jesus, got this image of Jesus that starts out the book of Revelation. And so I'm going to read it to you. It's from Revelation 1, starting at verse 12. Then I turned to see the voice who was speaking to me. And on turning, I saw seven golden lampstands. And in the midst of the lampstands, one like a son of man, clothed with a long robe and with a golden sash around his chest. The hairs of his head were white, like white wool, like snow. His eyes were like a flame of fire. His feet were like burnished bronze refined in a furnace, and his voice like the roar of many waters. In his right hand he held seven stars. From his mouth came a sharp two-edged sword, and his face was like the sun shining in full strength. If safety is your goal, or as Francis Schaeffer put it in a book he once wrote, personal peace and prosperity, if that's your goal in this life, then don't follow Jesus. He is not primarily concerned with your personal peace and prosperity or mine. He is concerned that I develop his character in my life. He is concerned that I obey him. He is concerned that I make my life about something bigger than just my own little realm. He is concerned that I have my sins forgiven, which is why he died. He's not safe. Being in his will does not ensure that we are going to have a great time and have it easy. Being in his will, more often than not, will challenge us, just as it challenged those disciples. So what about you today? Are you doing what you know to be God's will, but then finding yourself in trouble? We've probably all been there. Sometimes, like the time for the disciples, the trouble is directly connected to the fact that you are doing God's will. He tells you to talk to a neighbor, and it's very clear. Go talk to that neighbor. And the neighbor shuts you down. He tells you to be truthful about a situation at work, and rather than the person who isn't being truthful getting punished, you do. He sends you a place you don't want to go, and once you get there, you find out, why did I come here in the first place? You have a million questions that aren't answered. Here's a vital principle of our lives. Without difficulties, without trials, without stresses, without failures even, we would never grow to be what we should become. Having the image of Christ formed in us is not natural to us. It's going to take some stress, just like it takes stress to be a top-notch athlete. It's going to take some stress to have the image of Christ formed in us, and that's what God, that's what Jesus is concerned with. So we can be right in His will. Don't let anybody tell you, you can be right in the will of God and you will always be happy and blessed and blah, blah, blah. In the end, you will be. But for a short period of time, you can be very much in trouble. But there's hope. There's hope. I think it'll be seen that this storm had a purpose in God's plan. This storm just didn't hit the disciples arbitrarily. They were going to experience Jesus in a way that they could not have experienced Him without the storm. So let's move on. So you're in the storm. Sometimes Jesus seems indifferent when we need Him the most. Here's the text. And as they sailed, He fell asleep. Now, again, when they started up, it was calm. Just like after you've had a long day and you're in a boat and it's kind of gently that you'd fall asleep too. Mark tells us he was asleep. There was a pillow up in the front of the boat and he laid his head down on that, probably a sandbag or something else like that. And he went to sleep. He was exhausted. In his human body, Jesus got very tired. And he fell asleep. And it's like right when he falls asleep, a windstorm came down on the lake and they were filling with water. And they were in danger. Now, amazingly, this storm hits, and Jesus was so exhausted, He had already fallen asleep. And here's the disciples now fighting for their lives while their master and teacher is still asleep. He was really tired. Even the storm apparently isn't waking him up. Now, when we go through storms, and we all go through them, right? We go through them. Has it ever seemed to you that in the midst of the whole thing, when you need Jesus the most, you're not hearing from Him? No matter how much you beg, no matter how much you plead, the door of heaven seems locked. C.S. Lewis put it this way. He wrote a book called A Grief Observed about the death of his wife and what he went through internally while he was grieving. He writes this, "Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing Him, so happy that you are tempted to feel His claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to Him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to Him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, and what do you find? A door slammed in your face, and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. There are no lights in the windows. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? Well, it seemed so once, and that seeming was as strong as this. What can this mean? Why does He seem to be so present a commander in your time of prosperity, and a very absent in a time of trouble?" Have you ever been through that? Tim Keller, who just passed away this last May, tremendous author and pastor in New York City, writer of a lot of great books, the best of which, if you've never gotten it and read it, I think is Walking with God Through Pain and Suffering. If you're interested in that subject, I would get that book and read it. It's one of the best I've ever read on the subject, and it does answer some of these questions. Well, Tim got pancreatic cancer. He discovered it in the year 2020, right, during the pandemic. And he writes this, "My wife Kathy and I spent much time in tears and disbelief. We were both turning 70, but felt strong, clear-minded, and capable of nearly all the things that we had done for the past 50 years. I thought we'd feel a lot older when we got to this age. Kathy said we had plenty of plans and lots of comforts, especially our children and grandchildren. We expected some illness to come and take us, but only when we got really old. But not now. Not yet. This couldn't be. What was God doing to us? And during this time, he said, we went to the Bible often, and especially the Psalms, because the Psalms express exactly what he was feeling and what they were feeling together. Why, O Lord, do you stand far off? David had that feeling when he was running away from Saul. His life was being threatened. What's up? Psalm 44:23. Wake up, O Lord. Why are you sleeping? Rouse yourself. Psalm 13:1. How long, O Lord? Will you forget me forever? When we go through this kind of stuff, it is good to know that the Bible also expresses the very things we're feeling through the different characters in the Bible. Did you know that, again, the Bible, there's all kinds of different literature that makes up the Bible. There's one specific literature called the literature of lament. Pouring out your heart, your soul, your grief to God. The whole book of Lamentations, that's what it means, lament. Jeremiah lamenting what happened to Jerusalem when the Babylonians came and took it over and destroyed everything, including the temple. The one thing that, to the Jewish people, expressed the presence of God with them was gone. Does that mean you're gone too, God? It's what it feels like very often in the middle of the storm. We can't ignore this. We can't ignore it. It is. And when we talk to one another as we go through different storms together, I think it is the worst thing we can do for people to try to hurry them along out of that stage. It's a little bit cruel. We need to feel these things as we go through storms. And the reason we need to feel these things is, again, we learn the most about God when we go to the depths and it feels like he isn't there. We're going to see that that's not the end of the story, but man, it sure feels like it when we're going through it. If you find yourself in a storm, despite doing the will of God, and as you're in it, Jesus seems completely indifferent. 2 weeks from now, I've invited a man named Charles Mwamvaniza to speak here. Charles is from Rwanda. He has an unbelievable story. In 1994, he and his first wife were nearly killed during the genocide in Rwanda for being a Tutsi, or for being a Hutu. I'm sorry, a Tutsi. When the new government took power in Rwanda, he then was almost killed for also being a Hutu. He was imprisoned for 2 years. You're going to hear his story, but what happened was that in 2007, our church in Temecula, Rock Ridge Church, we were doing an outreach into the community around us, and my cousin actually went by, and so we were doing brochures to the houses and passing them out. And that's when we met Charles. He was staying with some friends of his. He had just come from Uganda, where he had fled the government of Rwanda. And he was there by himself. His wife and his 7-year-old child, his second wife, his first wife left him. His second wife and his 2-year-old child were still in Uganda. But he had been able to come here because he had a U.S. visa. They couldn't. Now, when we encountered Charles, it was the clearest thing that I think one of the clearest things I've ever heard from God, and that is, Mike, I put Charles here, and you guys got to take care of him. That's what I want you to do. And it was clear. One of the most clear things I think I've ever heard from God. Long, long story. Charles, despite the fact he had lost all of his papers because someone had stolen his backpack when he got here to the United States, we were able to get his asylum established. That took 3 years, from 2007 to 2010. His son was able to come here 2 years later. Now his two-year-old son was seven. He was able to come, but his wife couldn't come because our embassy in Uganda were saying they never got married. So we had a law firm who helped us out immensely. It was the law firm of Latham and Watkins in Costa Mesa. My sister-in-law worked for them. They put in hundreds of pro bono hours trying to prove that Charles and his wife Irene were married. I mean, it was reams of material that they sent to our embassy in Kampala in Uganda. I mean, we had the facts there. And all through it, all through while we were doing this, for some reason, it just seemed that God was being unresponsive as it related to Irene getting there. That's what it felt like. Our embassy was non-responsive. So let's stop there and let's move to the next point. The reality of the storm leads to desperation. Here's what the disciples did. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. I'm sorry, that's from Mark. They went to him and woke him. I don't have this one on there. They went to him and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we are perishing." That's the Luke passage. Here's how Mark put it. But he was in the stern, asleep on the cushion, and when they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" Don't you care? Here's the kind of boat they are in. It's just for your entertainment. Okay, this is a first century Sea of Galilee fishing boat, what it would have looked like. Imagine 13 guys in there. 13 guys would fit, but obviously it was a pretty full boat. Here's a model of the kind of boat they would have had. And here's an actual boat that was discovered in 1996. It was buried, had been buried for years along the Sea of Galilee. This was an important find because it proved that these fishing boats that Jesus and his disciple used were big enough for 13 people. All right, so that's the kind of boat they're in. Now, Jesus was asleep. Luke's account is a little bit abbreviated. In Matthew, they address Jesus as Lord. In Mark, they address him as teacher. And here in Luke, they address him as master. And so that's, they were crying out. They were desperate. You ever been that? You ever been desperate? You're just crying out. Kids get desperate, right? And they scream and yell, and you're trying to calm them down so you can do something about it as a parent or a grandparent. They get hurt. Hold still. I can't hold still, right? Going through something like this does bring a bit of desperation, and the disciples now at the end of their rope. And imagine this, Peter, James, and John, veterans at handling the Sea of Galilee, realize they're over their heads here. In desperation, they're calling out to Jesus. Now, back to Charles and Irene. One of the elders and I went to Uganda in 2013 to the capital city of Kampala to plead the case that we were making through the lawyers, and everything had been done through email. We thought it might be a little bit impressive if we actually showed up at the doorstep. So the church sent us. We went there, and there came the night before we were to meet with the person at the U.S. Embassy to try to talk reason and plead for her case that they were married. There was evidence for it. The night before we were to meet with the embassy person in charge of Irene's case, I got to tell you, after everything we'd been through, I was down on my knees and I was pleading to God, please resolve this. We've been at this already for 6 years. We've been at it for 1 year with her. This is unfair. It's unjust. And you know it's unjust. People come through the U.S. borders all the time. Now we got one person trying to do it the right way, and you're not letting them in. I was on my knees, literally. God, please. When we got there, the embassy worker, and there's only one person deciding this case, by the way, at the embassy, apparently had her mind made up. And we didn't talk, you know, in the same room. You're talking through plexiglass that's about 6 inches thick. We presented her with the reams of information. They had already gotten it. In fact, the ream of information was so thick it shut down their email for a while. They were not happy about that. We said, here it is. Have you looked at it? Yes. But I interviewed her, and she was told, I don't think they're really married. You don't think? Shouldn't you be absolutely certain? I didn't say it that way, but that's sure how I was feeling. God, why in the world would you do this? Why? What's going on? Let's go to the next point. We experience a deeper discovery of Jesus' power. This is crucial. And he awoke and rebuked the wind and the raging waves, and they ceased, and there was a calm. That's a pretty simple way to put that. When Jesus does things, it's pretty clean. There's no dramatics, so to speak. And it stops. Peace, be still. Jesus rebukes the wind and waves. The word rebuke that it uses here is the same verb that he rebuked the unclean spirits with. And the woman with the fever, Jesus rebukes all of that. Now, again, in the Gospels, these miracles show us what the kingdom of God is going to be like when it is here in all of its glory. All of the enemies that we have will be conquered. And Jesus said, I'm the king, and this is the kind of power I have. So first, the power of Jesus was applied to the situation. He calms the waves, and then he turns to his disciples and says, where is your faith? Have you ever had that kind of an encounter with Jesus? You're screaming, and then he does something and says, where was your faith? It's not so much as a chastisement. It is a, who do you think I am? Where's your faith? This is an applied faith that functions in the midst of pressure. It is a faith that has a depth of understanding and can be drawn upon during tough times. When we experience Jesus in this way, we're never the same. Now, this was immediate. Sometimes our storms take a while to settle down, don't they? Back to Charles and Irene. There's a process. So what happened was the embassy turned us down, just turned us down flat. We left Uganda feeling like total failures and hopeless. All right, God, done everything we can do. We've prayed. We've made books of information proving they're married. What are you going to do? Well, there's a process of appeal, thankfully, for something like this. And after we got back, Charles, without any other documentation, appealed to the visa center, which is located in Nebraska. And instead of, you know, like a book of information, he just wrote from his heart saying, I want my wife with me and the child that we have together. Why would you want to keep us apart? It was very simple. It was very simple. This 5-page appeal was sent, and guess what? They granted it. In 2015, 2 years after we'd gone to Uganda, all the prayers, all the turmoil, all the stuff, he wrote a little appeal, and they granted it. This is Charles and Irene and their son Marvin at LA International Airport in November of 2015. after 8 years, God came through. The result, here's the result. A deeper faith. The passage says, they were afraid and they marveled, saying to one another, who then is this that he commands even the winds and water and they obey him? They were afraid. Why? Well, because they just saw somebody put an end to a storm with just a couple of words. Ooh. They marveled. How can this happen? Then they asked the inevitable question, who is this? They were getting an idea of who Jesus was, but man, they just had an experience of who Jesus was that was second to none. And these guys knew and understood the Old Testament, and they understood that only God has the power over nature. And here was their rabbi, their teacher, their master, exercising control and power over the elements. Only God does that. And they began to connect the dots. He's more than a guy. He's more than just another rabbi. He is the one who controls the wind and the waves and nature itself. And they began to have a deepened faith of who Jesus is, a faith that would, of course, walk with him to the cross. They got sidetracked several times, didn't they? But in the end, these guys who had experienced Jesus in these ways and then finally experienced his resurrection when things did look totally hopeless, they knew who he was. Their faith deepened. It was no longer just a superficial thing. They all went to their deaths except John, with Jesus on their lips, saying, you can kill me, but I'm not going to be dead, because I'm with the one who was resurrected. Here's our application question today. How has Jesus met you in personal storms that has deepened your own faith? Is there someone in your life now who could benefit from your experience of Jesus' power over storms? We're going to pray.